We'd like to get started so that we'll have plenty of time for the paper, plenty of time for the response, and a little time, realistically, for questions afterward. As you can tell from your program, the topic of this session is Revelation, A View from the Grassroots. The paper is being presented by Irene Bates, whom I met over the telephone when she was corresponding with the Exponent crowd back in Boston. She is... Louder? Okay. She is a housewife. She has her... recently received her B.A. in sociology at UCLA. She's a former Relief Society president of Pacific Palisades Ward, which is in Santa Monica area in California, which the Relief Society of that ward, under her direction, produced a film called Reflections, which many of you might be familiar with. It's a film on women reflecting about the choices they've made in their lives and how those how they feel about those choices, and it's a very good film. And I guess the only thing that I would add after briefly meeting you and talking with you on a few occasions is that Irene appears to be a woman whose knowledge matches her zeal and whose charity surpasses both.
That's a description.
Following Irene's remarks, John Kessler, who's presently an attorney in Salt Lake, will respond to her paper. He has his B.A. in political science from the University of Utah and his law degree from Columbia. He was also did graduate study under Rotary International Fellowship at the University of Hamburg in Germany. And if there's any time after that, you're welcome to address questions to either the presenter of the paper or the respondent.
For those of you who have been sharpening your brains in these sessions can relax a little now. This really is the grassroots. In the June 19... Yes, does this... Is this working? Sorry. In the June 1977 issue of Exponent 2, there was a letter from a lady in Washington. Among other things, she said, and I quote, "We are encouraged and expected to bring wee ones to meetings. We are also encouraged to and expected to have many wee ones to bring." With both expectations, I agree wholeheartedly. But it would be grand if our buildings reflected a recognition of the needs that arise as a result of following this council. I have spent many a sacrament meeting trying to nurse a hungry baby in the last stall of the ladies' room. I usually sit and pray for an audience with the church building committee. After one particular trying week, I emerged from my usual Sabbath perch in the ladies' room, carrying a just-fed baby, and bumped into a good member of our ward, a man I love and respect. I expressed my dismay and then said, "I just keep praying someone on the church building committee will become aware of the needs of mothers and babies which aren't being met." He looked shocked. And then he said, "Sister Reese, this church runs on revelation. If the Lord had wanted all that in our churches, we would have been given it." When I read that letter 3 years ago, I recalled the many times I had encountered this same perception of the process of revelation as it relates to church policy. It's true that most of us, on a personal level, are well acquainted with that inexplicable prompting, the intrusion in our rational ordering of life. Most of us have read of visions and of turbulent manifestations of the elements, often seen as God's messages to man. But observation leads me to conclude, along with our sister in Washington, that some of us tend to think of revelation exclusively in those terms, as a direct, one-way line of communication from the Lord, giving unsolicited instruction to prophets and leaders. Yet in our own lives, there are also the more common instances when light comes only after conscious awareness of a situation or problem, after long study or even painful struggle with persistent questions. And I couldn't help but think that revelation for the church might include both kinds, and so I look to history for answers. There I found, right from the revelation given to Joseph Smith in 1820 to the priesthood revelation given to President Kimball in June 1978, that generally speaking, guidance for the church has come via the more tortuous path. There has been a conscious awareness first, sometimes a struggle, but always a seeking for guidance. In B.H. Roberts' introduction to Volume 5 of The History of the Church, he says, "It is so generally the case that the revelations the prophet received came in response to inquiries, either by himself or by those who sought to learn their duty or to know some truth, that such inquiries may be considered as a precedent to his receiving revelation. At any rate, it is plainly a characteristic of the whole volume of revelations which Joseph Smith gave to the world." End of quote. Having confirmed this by researching the background of most of the Doctrine and Covenants, further questions loomed in my mind. For instance, if awareness and a consequent seeking for guidance are crucial elements in the process culminating in revelation, does not the environment itself assume great importance? And as members of the church, a part of that environment which precipitates inquiry, does it not follow that we have an obligation to be a truly honest reflection of what is, and consequently an illumination of what is needed? In a church of great demographic and geographic expansion, our leaders have to be sensitive to environment in all of the many cultures in which the church operates. So they are, in large measure, dependent upon honest feedback. Which leads me to a very simple question, and this really, I suppose, is the focus of the paper. Why, then, are so many of us inhibited in terms of giving honest feedback? Before trying to answer that question, I would like, first of all, to give some illustrations from church history, showing the vital role that environment has played in the process leading to revelation. Just a sample of the many I found. The most obvious, perhaps, is the Word of Wisdom, section 89. And most of us have heard the story of the smoke in the council room and of the repugnance felt by the prophet's wife, Emma, when she observed the state of a floor much spitted upon. But there were other compelling reasons for seeking the Lord's guidance at that time. In Max Parkin's Conflict in Kirtland, he says, and I quote, "Drinking liquors was a common practice in America during the opening of the West. Men, women, and children used it as a principal beverage. In fact, addiction to liquor was common to a large portion of the people." End of quote. In the Comprehensive History of the Church, B.H. Roberts says of the Word of Wisdom, "Because of its importance in the practical life of the Church, and also because it is an effectual refutation of the charges made about that time that there was toleration in the Church of gross intemperance, it is reproduced here in extenso." In section 51, the law of consecration, this revelation was given in Thompson, Ohio in May 1831 when there was a great influx of saints from New York, many of whom were poor and needed to be cared for. According to Max Parkin, this was during a period of increasing population without parallel in the history of this or any other country. The population had increased from just over 45,000 in 1800 to almost 938,000 by 1830. The revelation came also to replace the Morley family organization to which many of the converts had belonged and where property had been held in common. The continuation of that practice after baptism had led to many problems. Section 129, given in February 1843, gives guidance as to the discernment of good and evil spirits. This section followed an earlier statement by the prophet in which he addressed a very current problem. There had been all kinds of bizarre manifestations of the spirit by members which were proving an embarrassment to the church. He said in Times and Seasons, "Soon after the gospel was established in Kirtland, many false spirits were introduced, many strange visions were seen, and wild, enthusiastic notions were entertained. Men ran out of doors, and some of them got on stumps of trees and shouted, and all kinds of extravagances were entered into. One man pursued a ball that he saw flying in the air until he came to a precipice. when he jumped into the top of a tree, which saved his life. Despite the fact that these things were fairly common at the time, they were still seen by outsiders and critics of the church as abnormal and unchristian. Even the general directives given for the preaching of the gospel in section 4 were in fact given in answer to a specific inquiry arising from the visit of Joseph Smith Sr. to his son. The prophet wished to learn the relationship his father was to occupy to the work then coming forth. Section 64, calling the rebellious to repentance, was a result of a plea to the Lord when Joseph Smith returned to Kirtland in September 1831 and found much murmuring and outright rebellion, even among the leadership of the church. Such revelations may have proved of universal significance later, but at the time they were elicited as a result of personal awareness. In the early days of the church, most members and their concerns were directly observable or shared. The church in the 1800s was small, and it was confined to relatively small communities. It was a domestic, social, and economic institution as well as religious. Under such conditions, it was fairly easy to know what to ask guidance on. Today, the church is operating under vastly different conditions. Not only is the church empire far-reaching and of widely varying cultures, but the social and economic ties are necessarily limited. Because of these changes, there has to be a greater dependence upon the honest and caring response of members, in order that true context may be seen and the questions thereby illuminated. Technology has given us the means by which information may be gathered, and certainly the church structure is well able to deal with the problem of keeping in touch with local conditions. It is a perfect organization, right from the bishop, who ideally has a personal knowledge of each member of his ward, to state president, to general authority. There is an avenue for two-way communication. In many ways, and on occasions of personal crisis or major social tragedy, it does fulfill its purpose admirably. The process leading to revelation should not, therefore, be threatened by the size and complexity of a universal church. But experience, observation, and research lead me to believe the efficacy of the process by which revelation is sought might well be endangered. And the danger has its roots in some rather common attitudes or misperceptions which impede the general workings on the intended workings of the system. I'd like to illustrate three of those attitudes or views of revelation. First, the view that we are passive receivers only, as illustrated from my exponent quote. History shows that this is certainly not a new perception. In early September 1856, when the Willie and Martin Handcart Company set out for Salt Lake City from Florence, Missouri, most of the saints and their leaders saw that challenge as a trial of their faith and obedience. They heard only the stirring words of Brigham Young in October 55. Let them come on foot with handcarts or wheelbarrows. Let them gird up their loins and walk through, and nothing shall stay them. And if any apostatize in consequence of this regulation, the handcart company proposal, so much the better. For it is better that such deny the faith before they start than to do so for a more trifling cause after they get here. And if they have not faith enough to undertake this job and accomplish it too, they have not faith sufficient to endure with the saints in Zion the celestial law which leads to exaltation and eternal life. A few months earlier, Brigham Young had warned them about unnecessary delays because the devourer and tempter are abroad in the earth. Brigham Young compared the saints with the Israelites who had travelled 40 years in the wilderness. And so, back in Florence, with the handcart company, there was just one lone voice, Levi Savage, who protested at this late start. But the travellers and their leaders were determined not to be found wanting in their faith. Yet when that disastrous journey cost over 200 lives and strained the resources of the saints in the Salt Lake Valley in rescue missions, the prophet berated the leaders for following his word so blindly. He said, and I quote, "But if while at the Missouri River they had received a hint from any person on earth, or if even a bird had chirped in the ears of Brother Richardson Spencer, they would have known better than to rush men, women, and children onto the prairie in the autumn months on the 3rd of September to travel over 1,000 miles. And then he turned his attention to those who had been critical of his part. He said, "If anyone complains of me or my counselors in regard to the lateness of some of this season's immigrations, let the curse of God be upon them and blast their substance with mildew and destruction until their names are forgotten from the earth." End of quote. I think the tone of... Yes?
I recall from the words of Discourses of Brigham and Young by John Woodstone, he said, "I want every saint to pray over whatever advice I give them, and one of the worst things they can do is follow me blindly."
Yes, I've read that. And another one, there's another one too that's even more explicit. I think the tone of the speech well expressed the depth of Brigham Young's sorrow and anger. And it must be remembered that he had warned them earlier about the handcart companies. He said, "Only be particular to start them earlier in the season," but they didn't hear that. In modern times, it would be a simple matter to telephone or wire information, but one wonders if even now there would be many willing to raise questions, especially in the face of such proddings. There is an ever-present tendency not only to deify our leaders, but to reify their every utterance. Yet experience has taught my husband and me that prophets do need and do welcome feedback. Almost 20 years ago, when my husband was a stake president in England, it was church policy for a member of the stake presidency and two bishops to be invited to general conference. Then on one occasion, the invitation came through the European mission president, and it included all bishops and all branch presidents. This was such a radical departure that my husband Bill called the mission president to make sure he had interpreted the message correctly. He was assured this was the case. Still he held out, feeling sure there would be a correction. When none came and he was being pressed for names, he finally called each bishop and branch president and extended the invitation. There was much rejoicing. One faithful branch president was especially thrilled. He had, in effect, lived the law of consecration for many years, and he and his wife had been the mainstay of their little branch in a small cotton mill town in Lancashire. Among other fundraising activities, he had worked every Saturday as a ditch digger in English weather, giving the money he earned to the church building fund. When the invitation to go to Salt Lake arrived, he became a celebrity overnight in his little community. There was an article in the local newspaper, and his boss gladly gave him extra vacation time so he could attend conference. Then the blow fell. There had been a mistake, after all. The mission president called to say only the stake president and two bishops were invited, no branch presidents at all. Bill spent several sleepless nights. He knew what it would mean in that little town. He didn't doubt the branch president's courage, but he knew what a deflating experience that might prove for the members, and he knew it would inflict much damage to the credibility of the man and of the church. He telephoned the mission president, telling him this, but it was difficult for that good man to comprehend the extent of the blow. He simply said, "Those are our instructions." After much struggle and prayer, my husband telephoned President McKay while I trembled outside the door. He told him the story and offered to forgo his own opportunity in exchange. Within seconds, President McKay answered, "You are quite right, President Bates. We cannot do that to that faithful man and his little flock. Thank you for telling me about it, and thank you for your offer, but it won't be necessary. Let him come, let them all come this time." And then he added, "But let me communicate this correction through the proper channels." Bill came out of his office in tears. He was deeply touched by the humility of the mission president too, who passed on the message without rancor and who continued to be our friend. I'm not suggesting that we telephone the prophet or try. Just to say that the proper channels are there. It is human beings that damn them. A second reason for the reluctance to be honest in our responses seems to me the fear of being thought presumptuous. We fear that our contribution might be seen as an attempt to steady the ark, instead of recognizing our very real obligation to report on the terrain and the obstacles that may be afoot. On more than one occasion, I have been guilty of that kind of misperception. For example, in our early years in the church, in a small branch in the Manchester area, there was a young woman in her mid-30s, a convert of just a few years. A refined, intelligent woman of deep spirituality, she had brought great dignity to her calling as Relief Society president. But she was black, and she was married to a white man. She and her husband and three children were all very active in the small branch they attended. When the middle child, their only son, reached the age of 12, the whole branch was suddenly confronted with the exclusionary policy of the priesthood. It was not common knowledge in many parts of England, and the members were shocked. They loved this family, and the women especially identified with the suffering of the mother. There was almost wholesale apostasy. But several weeks later, I happened to be visiting their Relief Society when she bore her testimony. She told them all very simply of her pain, and then she led them, stage by stage, through her own final acceptance. An acceptance made possible because she knew the Lord loved her and her son. She'd had the reassurance that the Lord was with her, and she had the faith that he would put the matter right. Everyone there was in tears, but it was she who brought that little branch back into the church. This was the beginning of a great internal conflict within me. I have wondered since whether the revelation of June 1978 might not have come earlier if a majority of our white membership had felt as the members of that branch had prayed and had expressed their feelings as they did. Perhaps, after all, the burden of change might well have rested upon the spiritual maturity of the white membership, as Eugene England suggested so beautifully in his article in Dialogue, Norman Cross. And I have wondered, too, how many, like me, have suffered that cross in relative silence because it seemed presumptuous to be more openly concerned. Perhaps, collectively, we could have provided an earlier, more favourable climate for seeking the revelation in faith, as Elder Bousar McConkie put it. A third reason why we hesitate to play our part is one that is certainly not without justification. There is in us a lack of faith, a fearing that our contribution may fall on stony ground, or even be given a hostile reception halfway up the ladder. This can and does result in a contagious apathy. In a universal church, this can be particularly dangerous. The gospel itself may not be culture-bound, as Hugh Nibley pointed out in his sesquicentennial address at BYU, but I do believe that people and policies to varying degrees are. As an English convert, I know all too well the self-discipline and the knowledge that is required to see the world through anything but one's own cultural lens. As a transplant, I can now view with a little more sympathy, at least, the intransigence of members of a mutual general board who insisted, in the face of all sensible argument, that female participants in England in athletics must wear Bermuda shorts. In England, where they would be tolerated only on eccentric, well-to-do elderly gentlemen. After a long transatlantic battle of kind words and persuasive photographs, my husband was MIA president then, the condition was waived. Mormonism, I find, has its own cultural expectations, which in a worldwide church do call for some adaptation. But without honest and fearless feedback, there would be none. Laurel Ulrich of Exponent 2 calls it nourishment. And so often we fail to see the needs our leaders have to be fed. Even though right there in our history, prophets have acknowledged this need. In January 1841, in a letter to Oliver Granger, who had been charged with the responsibility of settling the financial affairs of the church in Kirtland, Joseph Smith said, "If those letters from you had been received in their proper time, we probably might have acted differently at the last conference. But not having the information we desired, we acted to the best of our understanding." I still haven't found out what he's referring to. And then George Boyd tells us about Hugh B. Brown's talk to the faculty of BYU in 1961. Brother Brown said to the faculty, he asked them, to bring us your problems, to express your opinions, to be unafraid to think, and we want you to be sure that you need not fear the consequences of expressing what you think. We challenge you to bring your best thinking to us. We do not expect to always follow all that you suggest, but we do certainly need your help, and for that we plead tonight." End of quote. There are, of course, many reasons why we fail to respond honestly. Some may be noble, such as a reluctance to add to a leader's heavy load, or maybe a desire to avoid dissension. There is, too, the fear that one might be out of step oneself, and there is a reluctance to disturb a complacent self-image. There are those who need approval and resort to apple polishing to get it. There is the personal weakness of not wishing to admit anything wrong with one's own sphere of responsibility, and so on. But one of the saddest, I think, is that we are not supposed to think, only to obey. Not to debate anything in our minds, only to do as we are instructed. This is particularly distressing to me, I think, because it contradicts everything which the church represented at my conversion. There are missionaries here who can bear testimony to that. It was the gospel which lit up for me, and for so many others, a curiosity, an insatiable yearning for knowledge and truth and understanding. And this element, ever present in a missionary church, is, I believe, a real source of strength. The dynamic and vital quality which allows for exciting, expansive development. And it makes the church, besides being an indispensable vehicle for the propagation of the gospel, a viable institution which can deal with needed change or adaptation. In the September 1979 Ensign, Leonard Arrington told us, "A study of history can help us understand that each of us must magnify his or her calling, for many of the significant administrative steps in the church have come as a result of valiancy at the local level. On more than one occasion, local innovation and suggestions have been brought to the attention of church leaders, who then felt inspired to use them as the basis for church-wide programs. Much of what we now have in several church programs had roots in the initiative of individual church members. Priesthood welfare program, Sunday school primary, young women's program, relief society, holding fast day on Sunday, and many others." End of quote. History then tells us we have no need to fear to think or to be creative or to be honest, so long as we have at heart the welfare of the church and of all of God's children, not just church members. While such input might prove a mixed blessing in bringing greater complexity to the decision-making process, I believe that it is only when one is aware of all of the dimensions that one's mind can be open enough to receive revelation. We do not know what precipitated the long struggle leading to the June 1978 priesthood revelation, but I was deeply touched by President Kimball's honest account of his own confrontation as reported in the Deseret News. He said, and I quote, "I had a great deal to fight, of course, myself largely, because I have grown up with this thought that Negroes should not have the priesthood, and I was prepared to go all the rest of my life, till my death, and fight for and defend it as it was." End of quote. We are, all of us, a part of the environment in which such revelations are sought. So what comes to us from the Lord by way of revelation through the prophet may in some measure depend upon us. The only real alternatives to that understanding would be either to believe that prophets are omniscient, or else that God provides all the questions as well as the answers. And whilst there are those who do think on these lines, I'm quite sure that either position would represent quite a challenge to our stated belief system.
It's clear that this paper is a paper by a faithful Latter-day Saint and is addressed to faithful Latter-day Saints. And I feel that it's probably most appropriate to respond in the same context as a faithful Latter-day Saint to faithful Latter-day Saints, although I realize many of you here may not be Latter-day Saints and I may not be as faithful as I'd like to represent. But I think we might most productively respond to Sister Bates' paper in this context, and that's what I'll do. I grew up a non-member of the church in Salt Lake City and didn't join the church until I was going to law school in New York City. And during that time, one of my basic assumptions about Mormons was that as a group, they tended to be sheep-like. They had a very strong tendency to respond to whatever authority happened to be available and walk like robots off the cliff or whatever it was. Except when I joined the church, I was surprised to find that when at times I was vocal or concerned or whatnot, that there was a fair amount of responsiveness. And in recent years, as I've had a few positions of responsibility, and right now I'm a bishop in the church, I've had the feeling that there certainly are a lot of people who are frank with church leaders and say what they think, et cetera, et cetera. And yet, Sister Bates feels that there are really massive numbers of people who either are totally passive by misunderstanding of church doctrine, or who are frustrated for one reason or another, or have psychological problems. And as I read over her paper and thought about it more and more, my final conclusion was that I was convinced by her, and I'm grateful to her for helping me be more sensitive, or deciding to try to be more sensitive as a church member, to take the responsibility to be discerning about what's happening and how policies are or are not meeting the needs or fitting the circumstances. And also hopefully I can be a bishop who's more responsive and maybe even teach that principle a little bit for those who had that misunderstanding. Yet, taking it to one further dimension as I pondered over this paper and even prayed about it, I developed one significant concern, and that was something that essentially was not said in the paper rather than something that was said, which may not be the fault of the paper given its design scope, but I think it concerned me greatly. So let me just briefly, in a synopsis, state what I think the paper is saying so I can make sense to you of what my concern is. I think basically what is said in the paper is that church leaders make decisions and receive revelations as a response to some context. And so there needs to be a context in which is created. There is a perfect opportunity for this to happen given the structure of the church hierarchy and whatnot, and doing what everyone is supposed to do. But the real breakdown in the system seems to be that individual members are not meeting the increasing needs of the church in the multifarious cultures and circumstances we find our branches and wards and stakes and missions to give the honest feedback that they should. She goes on to list several different reasons why people are hesitant to do so or don't give feedback. The misunderstanding of the that members are simply passive receivers of whatever comes down. They don't want to be presumptuous, lack of faith, well, just a belief that whatever they might express, will no one will listen to anyway, and numerous others. But those were the three that I think Sister Bates discussed intelligently and with good references and good examples and in a delightful manner. And she states the focus of her paper is to describe these problems, why people don't do such and such. But as I read the paper, I realized that this was not simply a sort of an abstract academic attempt to describe a given circumstance in the ward. It's really a consciousness-raising paper. It's not only saying this happens, but it's also saying, hey, you out there, you members have a duty to do something, to respond, to create context, to let leaders know, to jump over the immediate leader if you have to under the proper circumstances. And the vital question which arises at this time, and which this paper frankly does not really address, that concerns me, and to the extent that it does, it concerns me, is exactly what is proper and what is appropriate, and how do you, and under what circumstances do you give feedback, so to speak. Take the example of the lady, Sister Reese, who was told by this obnoxious guy, no uncertain terms, if the Lord wanted it that way, that's the way it would be. What should she do? Should she write a letter or meet with the church building committee, as her secret desires had been? Should she threaten to apostatize? B, C, should she lead a protest march of nursing mothers through state conference general session? D, should she consult privately with the bishop? E, should she attend a pro-ERA convention and give a speech about chauvinism in the priesthood? Well, I think all of us would agree that some of these responses would be inappropriate, but I think the point is I suspect we all wouldn't agree as to which one of those are inappropriate. We have different feelings. And the one she gives, Sister Bates gives a couple of examples in her life of what has happened, and the one that seems to have inspired her greatly and there was a turning point in her life, she says in the paper, was this little branch in England that when they found out about the policy of the priesthood, there was almost wholesale apostasy. And goes on to say that she wonders if the majority of the white members of the church had felt and expressed the feelings that the little branch had, if the priesthood revelation would have come earlier. Now, this is the strongest thing she states on it, and yet does she really mean to say that if you don't agree with the policy, the option is to move to the verge of apostasy and be that dramatic? I doubt that that's what she would say if she developed her paper in this regard, but who knows? It's lacking. There are just a few implications and suggestions, and this is probably the most dramatic one. So perhaps you could go on to issues such as when does the duty of the member to inform the leader end, at what kind of circumstances, and when does the leader's responsibility to sole responsibility for revelation in his calling begin? Should you take a different position with regard to something like the structure of chapels not providing, or wardhouses not providing for facilities for nursing mothers, versus a situation where you have a policy sent out by the first presidency of the church in no uncertain terms about what the position was, such as the position on the priesthood bar to the blacks? Should you be able to get into civil disobedience, so to speak, to the laws of the church, where you might send the sisters out in Bermuda shorts in England and have a near riot by complying with the regulations, and then the next time out disobey that rule in order to contrast the reactions? Some of these things might have been explored, but the more I thought about it and tried to understand what would be most effective in taking a paper like this beyond where it essentially has gone, would be to continue with the exact spirit of the paper that is found in the title to the paper, Revelation from the Grassroots. And I think this is the key. And among many other places, could be addressed as follows. You are commissioned, this is in Doctrine and Covenants, the section 46, verse 7. You are commanded in all things to ask of God, who giveth liberally. And that which the Spirit testifies unto you, even so I would that ye should, in all holiness of heart, walking uprightly before me, considering the end of your salvation, doing all things with prayer and thanksgiving, that ye may not be seduced by evil spirits or doctrines or devils or the commandments of man. For some are of men, and other are of devils. I think when you come down to it, you have to rest on personal revelation in responding, because I think you'd inevitably run into problems to say, in any manual, in any given circumstance, call it the president of the church when A, B, or C, or D happens. And I would feel sure that President Bates, Sister Bates' husband, did receive personal revelation, was inspired by the Spirit to jump over probably three or four or five hierarchies and call it the president of the church. And yet, as this scripture states, there are other spirits that abound and that people can receive revelation from. And I suspect that this little branch that was on the verge of wholesale apostasy was under the influence of another spirit. So when we're talking about revelation, it's being in tune with the Spirit of Christ and the Holy Ghost. So in conclusion, I'd simply like to say that I'm just certainly grateful to Sister Bates for her call to action, that we need to, on the grassroots, to get moving, and the leaders need to learn to respond. I think most leaders understand that, particularly the higher up you go in our church hierarchy. But it's a tremendous call and an exciting thing, and I'm sure that the welfare and the progress of the church depends upon more people out in the grassroots doing what they should do in providing this feedback, particularly by getting revelation of not only what the policy is that should be changed, but how to approach your rabble-rousing, so to speak. But I would like to just say one last thing, and that is, I think there's probably a more encompassing principle that this principle that we've been talking about has to be understood within, and it's one I think that President Kimball has reminded us of frequently in the recent conference sessions, and that is that the church will also progress as a whole, and fundamentally progress as a whole in the world, dependent upon the individual righteousness of its members. And I think that quite often, in spite of realizing this very valid call to action and shoot it up the channels or over the channels or whatever, that if people are striving towards righteousness and are close to the Spirit and run into a situation that's difficult for them, for whatever reason, if it's because the time is not ready yet, or they don't understand the implications of it, it may be better to put up with a bishop who insists on an obnoxious policy rather than live through the implications of what the change might mean. I think that oftentimes when you have this kind of difficult situation, the Spirit will whisper to you that it's probably more important to endure it silently and in humility. And I'd like to leave these thoughts with you in the name of Jesus Christ. Amen.